Rather than sit down there and have no work, people said, look, you better go and knock on the doors of managers and say, I'm free, I'll do anything. You know, want me to do the photocopying or whatever. And so I had to do that because otherwise I would just sat there and my default would probably be I just sit there.
Right.
And yeah, you know, I might have done the media or photocopying or whatever, but if I did a good job, people remembered me.
Before we get started on today's episode, we would like to acknowledge the traditional custodians of the land on which this podcast is recorded, the land of the Darug people. We would like to acknowledge and pay respects to our elders past and present and the next generation coming through. Now, onto today's episode.
Welcome to the Level Asian podcast. In this episode, we're joined by Karen Loon, a former senior Big Four partner, diversity practitioner, and author of Fostering Culturally Diverse Leadership in Organizations. Join us as we discuss the importance of diversity and inclusion in the workplace, exploring mentorship, and hopes for the younger generation. Enjoy the episode.
Let's talk about, I mean, obviously, congratulations.
Yes, congratulations.
Not even mention that, but the launch of the book. And I guess if you were to summarize what the book is about, you know, let's just say someone's walking across the bookstore and they see the cover. Yeah. How would you describe it in your own words, what the book is about?
So I'd probably say it's really there for two audiences. The first one is really aspiring culturally diverse leaders. So Asian Australians who are young, they might be feeling like they're struggling a bit with their careers and wondering, well, you know, what do I do? So I've actually written it to help them on helping them negotiate what they need to do in their careers. And then the other one is really around companies. So I wanted something to help companies really to think about what they could do around cultural diversity.
And you were telling me just before recording that obviously you actually wrote this as a thesis to begin with, and then it sort of someone suggested that you turn that into a book as well. So I know you're repeating yourself a little bit, but is it possible for you to sort of walk us through that process of the sort of the genesis, I guess, of or the idea of the book?
So maybe I'll go back to why I did my study.
Yeah.
So I've always had an interest in trying to give back and help the next generation in Australia. So I thought, well, maybe I need to go back to school because I've got all this practical experience. So I was a diversity leader at PwC and had learned from my mistakes on how you can try and roll programs out, how you can support people. But I wanted to try and say, do something because there was no books out there when I was looking. So, you know, there's a lot of books on gender and a lot of books on situations in the US. There was nothing in Australia. And so I thought, well, how can I help people and particularly also companies? And so someone said, look, don't write another book or don't do research on the barriers. Don't look into the bamboo ceiling because we know that. Why don't you actually try to understand the experiences of current leaders or people who've made it to try and work out what to do? And so that idea, which someone suggested, then led me to do that as part of my executive master at Change in INSEAD. And I loved the process, really enjoyed speaking to these people. And someone had suggested, who read my thesis, said, look, why don't you write a book? So it sort of was my research, original research, and they said, look, this will be useful. See what you can do to turn it into a book.
Yeah, wow.
Yeah.
What was the reaction like when the book was published? You know, because it can be seen as quite a contentious book in the sense of addressing something that, you know, say here in corporate Australia, that oftentimes they bury their heads in the sand and ignore that. But, you know, what was the initial response?
Yeah, so I think the younger people really appreciated it. Yep. So, you know, people who saw it or they saw some of the articles I wrote beforehand said, look, wow, this is something I thought about before, but you've actually put it in writing. And so I think that was really good. There have been some corporates coming and asking me to chat to them, I think, which is great. And that's what I want, is actually that I can help companies who have done a lot of stuff on gender, but they're like, well, what do we do now? We've got a lot of young employees from culturally diverse backgrounds and they're leaving. So what can we do better? What can you share with us? And so I am starting to chat to a few of those organizations and I'm hoping there'll be more.
Nice.
What kind of findings are you uncovering so far?
There's a lot of findings.
Yes.
Yeah. So maybe I can chat a little bit more about for the companies. I think one of the things that I have found and I think which is really interesting is how company cultures can stifle diversity. So if you think about a lot of companies, they all have unofficial rules, you know, the way that things get done. And you know, when you join companies, you find out, oh, I can do this here, but oh, no, you can't say that or you can't do that. And so I think that's one of the things that we have to remember. We talk about diversity programs, and a lot of companies put into place, you know, work-life balance arrangements, policies, procedures, targets. But actually the company culture can actually stifle diversity. Mm-hmm. And so one of the things I talk about and I think that companies need to think about is what can they do? How can you actually create an environment where everyone thrives, everyone feels safe, and people naturally go through the ranks and make it into leadership without the culture stifling people and people sort of leaving?
Yeah,
right. So I think that's sort of the one from the company side. And then there's heaps of others from the individual side as well.
Mm. But I definitely want to go back to that later in the podcast. Yeah. But I think naturally, you know, you always need to know who the person is behind the book, the expert. Naturally, as, you know, sort of Asian Australians, we sort of focus on the upbringing. So if we sort of wind it all back to what life was like for you, can you sort of tell us about, you know, baby Karen, so to speak? You know, where did you grow up? What was, you know, childhood like for you?
It was very unconventional for anyone. So I'm fourth generation Asian Australian. Mm-hmm. I was born in Tamworth. So if anyone knows of where Tamworth is, they know it's like 5 hours from Sydney and it's the Australasian country music capital. So they just laugh at me because they look at me and go, what? But, yeah, I've got family from – mum's family's from Darwin. Yeah, and there's a lot of Chinese who came in the late 19th century and earliest 20th century to Darwin. So there's a lot of family there. My dad's family's from Tasmania. So my grandmother and my dad were born in Tasmania and another grandfather was born in Tumut. Yeah.
What?
Yeah.
Wow.
Okay, so let's unpack this a little bit.
It's really, really unconventional.
Fourth generation, firstly, because, you know, and not by design, but certainly like many of our, because our age, we talk to mainly second generation and to a certain sense, sometimes third, but fourth generation is really interesting for me to unpack because, and not to mention Darwin and Tasmania, which are not sort of known to be sort of Asian capitals, right? So can we talk about your mum's side and then your dad's side a little bit? I'd love to sort of understand where that sort of origin came from and what they do. Yep. So maybe with your mum's side.
Yeah, mum's family were my grandmother was born in Pine Creek and that's like a long way from Darwin. My grandfather, we think, was born around there. Mum was born there as well. And, she was born there, but there was a bombing in Darwin.
Oh.
Yeah, so they actually moved to Sydney. So she moved to Sydney when she was young. They got evacuated and mum grew up in Inner West. Yeah.
Wow. Yeah. Okay. And then dad's side?
Dad's side. So dad, there's a lot of, well, not a lot, but there are small numbers of Chinese who ended up as tin miners in Tasmania. Mm-hmm. So my grandmother was born in the north of Tasmania and then my dad was born on the west side of Tasmania in a really remote place. But yeah, I have my great-great-grandfather came to Australia nearly 150 years ago. So it's the anniversary of my great-great-grandfather coming to Australia next year.
And what was the reason or what was the motivation for coming to Australia? So
I think just really for a better life.
Opportunity.
Right? Yep, yep. But he ended up in Tasmania apparently because of issues in Victoria at the time with racism.
Oh,
was this during the White Australia policy period?
Before.
This was even before that.
About 1870, 1880.
Wow.
It's crazy to hear about how far back it can go.
Well, I just hear 1900, not, you know, 1800s, you know, because the 19th century.
Yeah.
And so then the decision to go from, I'm jumping all over the place, but then how did your parents meet and then they grew up in Sydney. Yeah. And then where did Tamworth come into
play? My dad had a business in Tamworth.
Right.
So what was he doing?
Air conditioning. And heating. Yeah. Okay. Very not a restaurant.
Yeah, I was gonna say. We just instantly assumed.
So I spent my first like 17 years in Tamworth.
Okay.
And the only kid in my class, or generally the only kid in my class who was Chinese.
Mm.
Yeah.
And what was childhood like, I guess, in Tamworth?
I mean, my family was pretty Australian. I always thought of myself as Australian and because I think that's the way we were brought up. So I didn't really know a lot that different. I mean, I always used to go to Sydney on my holidays because my grandparents were in Sydney. So I got exposed to, you know, more Asian food and you know, different parts of my family there. But it was pretty Australian. I mean, when I say unconventional, I did grow up eating Vegemite sandwiches and meat pies. But I do remember my mum also fed me Vegemite and congee and butter. So it's a little, I'm a little confused. Yeah. But you know, it was different. It just wasn't my place. And so eventually I came to Sydney and went to uni down here.
Okay. Yeah. So it was a decision sort of deciding where to study, you know, for tertiary.
Partly, yeah. And yeah. I wanted to come back to Sydney. I wanted to go to college at Sydney Uni. So I went to Sydney Uni.
Yeah. And what did you study?
Economics,
yeah, okay.
Because that was the program you did at that time. It was a Bachelor of Economics if you wanted to become a chartered accountant. Okay. And I decided that, you know, or someone had suggested, why don't you start and become a chartered accountant? So
you're like, sure, why not?
I didn't know any different, so yeah. I ended up, yeah.
Yeah, okay. And then obviously moving into uni and then the professional career environment, I sort of would love to know that timeline because I think we usually oftentimes unearth a lot of a bit of self-therapy, oftentimes sort of sharing these stories because what that does sort of unpack is probably gives you an idea of why you've led down the career path that you have now as well. So are you able to sort of talk a little bit about sort of uni and then moving into sort of like working professionally?
Yeah, so I love uni. It was a great environment and quite different to Tamworth. So I think in Tamworth when you're the only person who's, you know, I guess even culturally diverse, you sort of are different. But when I went to uni, I think at that time, you know, my friends were Italian, Greek, Chinese, whatever. And so, but we were very Australian because I think people just had to grow up at that time and assimilate. Yeah. So I love that. Got involved with, you know, various activities in the accounting society. And through that, I actually got to know my previous employer, PW, was Pricewaterhouse then. And I loved the people I met. So I ended up deciding to join PricewaterhouseCoopers. Well, now it's called PricewaterhouseCoopers, but PwC from uni, because of the relationships.
And what were the big sort of milestones, so to speak, from a professional standpoint? You know, like you obviously would have worked your way up the corporate ladder and what have you. And then obviously Singapore came into play later down the track. So are you able to give us some of those highlights?
Yeah, so I love work. I work pretty hard. I think anyone who knows me would probably know that I used to work really hard. I did my profession, called it professional year there very early, and that helped me. So I actually was promoted from accountant to senior accountant after a year, which was good, you know. But I think eventually I sort of probably slowed down a bit. And I also wanted to work with different types of clients. I always wanted to work with more financial services clients. And I guess the other thing is most people who become chartered accountants at that time wanted to work overseas because, you know, it was an internationally recognized qualification. So, after I qualified, I decided to apply for an overseas secondment. Originally, for some reason, I wanted to go to the Netherlands. I didn't want to do London. Typical Australian went to London.
Why the Netherlands?
I just thought, well, they actually were working in English and it didn't seem to be, you know, wasn't quite like the UK.
Yep.
I didn't think I would fit in there. Didn't get that opportunity. But at that time they said, well, why don't you think about Singapore or Hong Kong? Because the economies were booming. And then I said, okay. and I only speak English. So I chose Singapore. And I think they may wait. Oh, okay. So I went to Singapore when I was 25. Got great opportunities because financial services was booming then. And I got to work with a lot of really international clients. And my 2 years secondment turned into a very long stint there.
Wow.
And I left after a total of 29 years, well, 25 years in Singapore.
Wow.
Yeah.
Wow, lots to talk about there. That 25 years and particularly around sort of, again, going back to the corporate ladder and sort of making your way up. So how high did you get, you know, for those people who don't know who you are? And,
yeah,
you know,
yeah. So I worked my way through. I made it to partnership in 2002. And so I was a partner with PwC in Singapore for 17 years. So by the end of it, I was a senior partner responsible for a very big audit engagement of a financial institution in Singapore. And I was a banking capital markets leader, so it's an industry role. And I also was the diversity leader in Singapore for 5 years, as well as the Asia Pacific diversity leader. So they were a number of different roles I had. So the day job was audit banks. And then I did various other roles, including my diversity leadership role.
So in terms of diversity leadership roles in corporate especially, for those who aren't familiar with it, can you explain what that role entails?
For me in Singapore, my diversity leader role was basically that I would work with my senior partners as well as the various groups, your HR groups, the business units, to try to support rolling out our diversity programs. So at PwC, we actually had a global framework, a methodology, and then the local diversity leader would be responsible to work out how best to tailor it and to work with, you know, HR about how they build it into their policies, to work with, sit down with the business unit leaders on how do we best try to look at, for example, their succession plans, you know, the inclusion side of things and that sort of thing. So it was really someone who was there to, I guess, guide them and work with the different units to roll out different initiatives.
Yeah, wow. I guess like you've also got an extensive background in accounting and finance and you've been a partner of PwC as well. Was some accounting something that you've always wanted to go into?
Probably not. Okay. if you said to me now, I'm not a, it sounds terrible, I'm not a big numbers person. I mean, I can, you know, I did the work, but what I really liked was the people. And I was actually in audit. I know a lot of people don't like audit. It's got a bit of a bad name. But it was, you got to work with a lot of really great people in small teams, and you got to work with lots of really interesting clients and get a lot of exposure to them very early on. So so that's what I loved. Actually, it was all about the people and the teams and young teams as well, which keeps you young.
So I guess out of curiosity, if you weren't doing accounting, were there other passions or dreams that you wanted to pursue beforehand?
Probably not, but I'm very organized. So I like organizing things, and you know, I always ended up being the one that organized other, you know, client conferences and things at PwC. So I think good project management skills is something that's always important in professional services, and I liked doing that sort of thing. Yeah.
I wanted to ask also, you know, being a diversity leader, like this was around what year was
2014.
So they, around 2014, PwC was already identifying sort of diversity as a, you know, a key area of focus or at least, you know, part of it. And this is what we're in 2022 now. So that's 8 years ago. And I feel like only in the last year or two here in Australia, that's been sort of a bit more focused. So would you say it was quite sort of like progressive in terms of thinking around diversity, or was diversity only sort of in a certain definition, was like more gender rather than race? Like what was that actual differences there?
I guess around that time, diversity and inclusion was very gender focused. And there were a lot of more Western countries focused on it. So Australia was actually doing a lot, US, UK, but it wasn't something that was as well known. So so I know I was involved with a number of discussions because my role included being on our global diversity steering committees. And, you know, one of the big discussion points that we were having was, well, how do we focus? We don't want to just focus on gender. How do we actually focus on other things? So we would focus on inclusion, and then we would also ask each market to pick a focus area. So it could have been disability, it could have been on culture, it could be on religion, whatever. So I think that was actually pretty advanced at that point in time, because it's true. A lot of companies were focused just on gender and doing nothing else. And it's probably true until recently, that's been the case as well. So reasonably well advanced, yeah.
And is the motivation around, I guess, writing the book, or at least the pathway that led to writing the book, based on, you know, for lack of better words, like your experiences working in a corporate environment, you know, the proverbial bamboo ceiling, which, you know, like, let's be honest, it's being talked about ad nauseum now. And, you know, you were very pragmatic, you know, off camera when we were talking about it. It's like, we have to, let's not keep talking about that and talk about like what can be done. But just to go back to the question, the question was really around, what motivated you to then decide to explore this further, even before the book, because you wrote a thesis on it as well. You know, again, all that, what's that sort of pathway led to that?
So I guess I became a lot more aware of the challenges that Asian Australians experienced, because I came back to Australia on a secondment as a partner from 2011 to 13. And so that to me was a bit of an eye-opener, because at that time I was one of, I think, probably two Asian Australian female partners out of about 500. And I wasn't even promoted in Australia. So it was an eye opener because I realised that, you know, there were no other role models for Asian Australian, particularly women, and there weren't even also a lot of men. So, and I didn't really notice it until some people started asking me for coffee. They were Asian Australians who weren't partners, and they would say, "Oh, can I have coffee for you?" And I'd go, "Okay." And then they'd say, "Oh, I want to have coffee because, you know, how did you become a partner?" and that sort of thing. And I don't have any female role models at all, let alone Asian Australians I can speak to. So that's always intrigued me. You know, so ever since then, I've been thinking, well, what can I do? It's not just about the business case, but what could I do? Because I've been so fortunate to have those opportunities myself. Mm-hmm. But, you know, how do I help the other ones who don't have any role models or need just someone to talk to make it? But I also know it's really hard as a leader to try and change cultures because, you know, a lot of people don't want to change. You know, they'll sometimes say, well, why do we need to change? Things are good. You know, it's been the things that we've done around here for years. And people also get quite anxious, you know. So leaders may not be even themselves open to targets or quotas or measures because they may feel they miss out or the culture will change or something like that. And so I found actually trying to roll programs out also difficult. So I wanted to try and say, well, what can we do? And that's sort of led to my research, which is based on personal experience as well as, you know, experience of others.
Can you touch on your personal experience a little bit? I know that you've said that the younger generation has come through and asked you about your experience and how they don't have any female role models, but did you yourself have female role models? And I guess we'll go on after that.
Yeah. In Singapore, it was really interesting. So when I first went there, at that time in Australia, I don't think I'd ever seen a female partner in my division. So, and I remember there was one lady who became a partner and she was pregnant. And that was like a real novelty in that time in 94. Yeah. But when I went to Singapore, it was really interesting because there were already female partners there. And, you know, I remember one lady had four kids, another had three kids, you know, another partner was pregnant at the time.
Right.
And so you saw people who had made it. And yes, it's true that in Singapore there's a lot of family support, but there were role models there. So so that was actually something that led me probably unconsciously to say, look, I'm going to stay because I can see there's an opportunity for me to progress if I had decided to have kids and that sort of thing. So, but, yeah, it's not easy when you don't see anyone, which is where I think, you know, we need to have more role models for people, more people talking up as well, because when you actually see someone who's made it, it does sort of unconsciously, you know, make you think, well, actually, maybe I can do it as well. It's not impossible. Yeah.
And why do you think Singapore was so much more progressive compared to Australia? I know that we are quite slow here just in general, but where is that disparity or where's that gap, I guess?
Yeah, it's an interesting place because sometimes I think people think that, you know, women don't have as many career opportunities in Asia. But and that's, I think, because the media in the West has sort of had this portrayal of Asian women as being, you know, quiet and meek and mild. But I actually think it's really interesting because in a lot of the markets, particularly ones with Chinese, you know, backgrounds, there are a lot of very successful women. So, for example, in Thailand, the Philippines, you know, historically, you know, they never had diversity programs. And you've got heaps of women, particularly in, say, my industry, which was accounting. So I think women in certain societies are strong. I mean, a lot of Chinese mums are so strong.
Yes.
And they're scary. And and you think they're meek and mild and they don't necessarily yell.
Until you meet a tiger mum, that's for sure, yeah.
And they may not be tigers in that way, but they can be really firm.
Yes.
And they can be very effective. And I think, you know, there are skills that, you know, women can bring. And, yeah, they've had a lot of, you know, family support as well. So I think it's just this culture that you can do it. And women tend not to drop out of the workforce to have kids. They actually, at least in Singapore, may drop out of the workforce when their kids are older at high school because of exams, but they tend not to drop out of work when they have kids.
Why is that? I mean, why high
school? There's a lot of pressure from education perspective, and some women decide that they want to be at home to support their kids, but later on. But usually they've got a lot of family support, you know, mom, you know, they've got helpers, you know, you've got childcare, a lot of help. So I think it's maybe that family idea, right? That families are there to support the next gen. And so I think that helps. Whereas I think in Australia, you tend to, you know, grow up and you have to do it all yourself.
Yeah.
Or you think, I have to be super mum. Yeah.
But I guess it's also like Asian culture is more like our last podcast guest, Heaven, we were talking about how family is so ingrained within the Chinese and the Asian culture, but versus in the Western side of the culture, it's very individualistic. And you, like you said, you fend for yourself.
Yeah.
I wanted to ask, going off of family, in your book and in our prep call, we spoke a lot about how family situations affect the way that we carry ourselves in workplace culture. Can you go into a little bit about that and your findings around that? Yeah.
So it was really interesting because so many people I spoke to shared examples of their family, and then they realized through the discussions I had with them how family actually shaped how they behave as adults. So, you know, one thing, I think a lot of people said they were very resilient. And I think resilience is definitely something that is a leader value for a lot of people with culturally diverse backgrounds. So I think I went and did some additional reading. Apparently, it often comes through when families experience a collective trauma. So the collective trauma is like, you know, the society has experienced, you know, being involved with wars and stuff like that as well. So if you actually think of a lot of leaders today, they might be of, you know, even Sri Lankan background or Vietnamese backgrounds, and then they've come to Australia. So they've actually got a lot of resilience because their families have actually been resilient to deal with it, and these things pass through. So I think resilience was one thing. Anxieties, I think definitely the parental anxieties are things that impact everyone because they feel they just have to keep working and being better than they are and always feeling that they're not good enough. And I think that a lot of it also comes from the fact that they are school migrants, children, or they're school migrants themselves. And so they feel that I've come to Australia for that. And another one is this whole concept of transference. And I think transference is an idea that sometimes unconsciously you act in a way that is like someone in your childhood. And I think that happens with everyone. But I think for a lot of people with Asian backgrounds, they tend to deal with very senior authorities, like an older man, like their father. And that played out, you know, so sometimes they you know, and that's true. When we're at work, I think same thing. If I'm with an older, in a room with an older man who's quite, you know, can be quite judgmental, can be quite tough, I'm really scared and then I overprep. So I think, you know, that's another thing of you know, I think family can play out because you sometimes behave as if you are in a family situation.
How interesting. Like, I've never really thought about it like that. Not that I treat you like you were my dad. But it's like, it's just, yeah, it's very interesting to think about how you might perceive a figure that looks like parental figure.
Yeah.
And how you might navigate how you work around that or how you approach situations as well.
Yeah. I think back to my corporate career. And certainly when first starting out, you know, fresh out of university, there was this aura to senior management, you know, and you often found them to be generally untouchable.
Yeah.
It was this sort of
narrative. Scared.
Yeah. You were scared. You were timid and probably didn't put a whole lot of value on myself as well. And I feel like a lot of Asian Australians still have that. Because again, going back to some of the research that you've done, you know, with the cultures and the values and the family environment, that sort of stuff that, you know, I sort of bundle that somewhat and probably for lack of better words, like self-limiting beliefs, because oftentimes that, you know, we say no to ourselves even before anyone has said no to us. And what that ends up doing is I find that that becomes a self-perpetuating thing where, you know, whether we call it the bamboo ceiling or something else, is that Asians sometimes don't feel like they're probably of enough value to contribute to whether it's an organization or a company or wherever, because they'd rather sit back and either be told what to do or they might have something that they want to say, but they don't know if it's going to be, you know, sort of well received or respected. Does that sound in line with sort of what you're seeing on your side?
Yeah, because I think one of the things that I found really interesting was that we learn how to operate in, I will use the word systems, you know, your family, then at school and that sort of thing based on your, you know, your early experiences. And so when you get to work, your default pattern is often what you've learned at home. And so the challenge is to be aware that, you know, people may not see you the same way as your family. You may need to learn to be a little bit different and agile and try different things, because what may work in your family and the behaviours of your family may not necessarily operate at work.
This episode is produced and brought to you by Social Wave. Social Wave is a strategic content marketing agency helping businesses grow revenue using video, podcasts and SEO. Head on over to socialwave.com.au to find out more. Now back to the show.
So what are some of those things then? Like if we were to say, you know, you've got someone who's about to come into the professional workspace, let's just, you know, for sake of familiarity, you know, they want to go into the Big Four.
Yep.
And they want to give themselves the best shot of making their way up and, you know, having a really good fist at their career. And they're Asian Australian. They probably have those sort of systems and beliefs that we just talked about. Is there a toolkit or is there a set of things that they can think about that they can apply and use that will help them, you know, sort of perform better?
Yeah. I think firstly being self-aware of what your default behaviours are is important, but learning to not to default to those, because sometimes they may not work. So I think that's one of them. I think another thing is really building different relationships and making sure that people know who you are. So I was just thinking then one of the things that may have helped me early on was I actually grew up at a time or went and started work in the early 90s, and then there was a recession. There was no work.
Mm-hmm.
And what was happening is they were going to start – they did lay people off.
Mm-hmm.
And so rather than sit down there and have no work, people said, look, you better go and knock on the doors of managers and say, I'm free, I'll do anything. You know, want me to do the photocopying or whatever. And so I had to do that, because otherwise I would just sat there and my default would probably be I just sit there.
Right.
And yeah, you know, I might have done the medial photocopying or whatever, but if I did a good job, people remembered me and then they would give me something else. So I think you need to sometimes get out of your comfort zone and do some of these things and build those relationships up. And if people think you're doing a good job, then they'll give you more work. But I think also remembering after that, that's not just the hard work. You need to build those relationships up.
It's so, like a common story, isn't it, amongst Asians? It's like we're taught, again, systems to put your head down, work hard, and you'll get noticed. Yep. When in actual fact, it's like, yeah, that'll get you to a certain stage in your career. But after that, it is network. It is relationships.
It's networks, it's relationships. And, you know, particularly in professional services, you are given more responsibility to manage people. So you need to learn those skills, which is, you know, a lot of it's all relationship. It's not about the technical side of things. Yeah. So learning about those sorts of things, but I think really trying different things out. And so when I spoke to some of the Asian Australian leaders, you know, some of them, a lot of them did secondments overseas. A lot of them also tried different things and volunteered to do things as well. But then, you know, recognizing that it's stressful. But they had these relationships, whether it was, you know, family, whether it was mentors, whether it was sponsors, were able to help them, because sometimes you feel very stressed, you feel very uncomfortable. But actually that's part of normal life in a lot of work situations, because you're learning new things, you know, learning to become a leader, learning to become a partner and that sort of thing.
Speaking of systems and family systems, also in your book, you spoke about how when we go look for a workplace or the workplace culture, we tend to go for places that feel like our own family systems or family organizations. Can you, like, again, can you expand on a little bit of this? Because I don't want to speak for you, but I'm very interested in that.
Yeah, I thought that was really an interesting observation that I had, because I actually used an interesting concept, which is sometimes used for research, which was drawings. So it's not very conventional. Usually when you do research, you ask people or, you know, do a questionnaire. But in this case, I actually asked them to do drawings of different situations and then describe it to me. And in many of the situations, particularly for the women, the Asian Australian leaders drew themselves at work. So I asked them to draw their work role, but they drew themselves with their family as well as their staff, which I thought was fascinating.
Wow, interesting.
Okay. Yeah. It was, I mean, I don't know, maybe because I also interviewed them during COVID and they were working from home, but there was a pattern, particularly for the women, in their work role, it was both they drew themselves with their family and it was like bigger, and then they drew their staff together in the one picture. And to me, I think there, it was interesting, because I got the sense that they wanted, the women, female partners wanted an environment that was like their family, and they could also mother and look after the younger people as well. So it is, I thought it was true because, you know, I think a lot of people love their family, you know, as a family is a space where they feel very much at home, they feel very comfortable. And in an ideal situation, they'd like that at work, in their, you know, fantasies maybe. Mm. Yeah.
I guess like from being a female, there is that nurturing side that the tendencies that just come with being a female. But I guess, do you think that affects how they treat work? And also how does that nurturing side, I guess, benefit as an advantage for leadership positions?
I think a lot of women, once they've made it into leadership positions, really want to give back. I think they've realized that, you know, they're in a privileged position. They actually feel also that that's a responsibility. Mm. And I think that's a good thing because people, you know, if I think about my own experience and when I was with PwC, it was my family. You know, I have a brother that went there. I met my husband there. Oh. It was actually my family and I grew up with them. And so, you know, I think that's something I think employers should be mindful of is that, you know, families are the types of places where we, you know, no matter what happens, you know, thick and thin, it's always there for us. And we want to belong at work. And I think if you think about our families, we belong to our families, even if, you know, we squabble and, you know, all sorts of things as well. And I think that's something that therefore is good. You know, women or, you know, men should actually also try and nurture their staff, look after them because people want to belong.
I think back to like now, you know, now running my own company, you know, we did a retreat a couple of months ago with our team and we sort of had, I had one-on-one catch-ups with each of the team members. And it was funny, Viv and I were doing ours and she thought it was going to be like a performance review.
No. I didn't think it was going to be. Anyways.
Well, anyway, my point was is that I think there was some. It wasn't what it didn't turn out the way that you expected it to, right? To a certain degree, and I think my big focus, sort of coming back from coming out of like 10 years of corporate, was that corporate in a very traditional sense, sort of. Pre-COVID, whatever you want to call it, there was the family values was not something of even of any. It was not in even in any of the dialogue or vocabulary at all. It was more just around performance, you know, helping the bottom line.
Yep.
It was to do with KPIs. It was a lot of that sort of stuff. Very, very measurable sort of impacts here. And I remember very vividly that, you know, sort of feeling like you got treated as just basically an asset or a resource. And your success or your value was directly tethered against your performance to deliver for the company.
Yeah.
And whether it was a subconscious or a conscious note on my side that I didn't want to have that situation in my own company now that I it's my own company. So therefore I could decide whatever the hell I wanted to do and how I wanted to do it. And so, you know, going back to the whole retreat and catching up with people, these conversations were more around, you know, how is life for you? You know, where do you want to go? What are your goals? What are your aspirations? What do you want to do, whether it's on a professional or a personal level? And I feel like only when you sort of holistically as a company or as a leader understand how your team members or your staff tick, can you make proper decisions that serve both the best interests of the business but also the people behind it. So do you have any insights or any thoughts
and
on that?
I think you've touched on that and I guess how I've also tried to look at diversity as well because, I mean, you know, I've been, you know, I'm also a non-executive director, so I have a particular interest in corporate cultures and, you know, what works. And I think, you know, If we look at diversity and you know, often the people didn't start say diversity, they go quotas, targets. In a way, that sounds like another KPI.
Mm-hmm.
And any KPI puts pressure on people and they, you know, people behave in different ways. Sometimes they don't behave particularly well because they're under pressure. They think I have to fight. It creates all sorts of dysfunctional behaviors. And so I think diversity measures are useful to see how we're progressing. But if we're really serious about what we're trying to do, we also have to recognize that we have to nurture this right environment. So it's not just putting KPIs, it's actually around looking after people, right? And trying to get that right balance. And I think you're right. Hopefully COVID has meant that we're not pushing people because all that pressure means that people, you know, have all sorts of challenges when it comes to, you know, well-being and that sort of thing. We need to look after them and give them that environment where they all feel comfortable and safe and they want to belong. And I think you know, therefore, when we're talking about how to increase diversity, we need to actually rebalance it back again, not just say, look, you know, we have to hit a number, because I just think that's not – it's useful to measure progress, but I think if we put too much focus on numbers, we're forgetting about the emotions that everyone has.
Yeah, I agree. Mm. And I'm probably not a good example because my whole team's Asian. But, you know, if you're – whether you're a business owner or company leader, particularly when you have an influence around, you know, your workforce and your team – what sort of advice do you have to give for them? Like they go, yep, I actually really want to focus on diversity and, you know, more specifically, if we're talking about Asian Australians here, how, what do you do in terms of like, I guess, supporting, you know, your staff members there?
Yeah, I think some processes are useful. And so, for example, I was talking to a company yesterday about, you know, saying, well, how do we try to, you know, encourage our leaders to support our people? And I said, well, for example, you know, sponsorship is really important, and trying to sponsor different people and giving them the opportunities, having people there to lobby with them. But do you, for example, actually have a way to make sure that you look holistically at who is in your talent pipeline and try to make sure that you haven't tried to favour people who have one style and not the other? So I think a lot of companies have done things with gender. You know, they've tried to make sure that we have, you know, a good slate of people coming through. We try to nurture the talent. I think, you know, one of the things for a lot of leaders is actually, are we also doing this with a cultural diversity lens on, or are we just favouring a certain type of person? So are we also giving them also equal opportunities for stretch assignments or secondments and those sorts of things? Because same thing, that we tend to prefer people who are like ourselves. So I think one of the things is to look holistically at some of those processes and try to make sure that, you know, we're giving those opportunities to people and also, you know, really encouraging them to also stretch themselves as well.
And I think there's like an empathy component to that because one of our clients who actually is in the accounting space, who I won't name just out of, you know, privacy, but they do things around, even little things around, you know, because people have different religious beliefs and cultural beliefs that they can choose their own public holidays, you know, like you sort of get to do that. And I think that's a recognition of giving a safe environment for people. Mm. And I certainly didn't necessarily, not that I had a problem with it. Like I love having Christmas off, but you know, we talk about like Lunar New Year.
Yep. Yep.
And whilst our requirement is that's when we're running back into the peak season of corporates all coming back to work and you got to be ready. The Asian belief or the Chinese belief in my cases was that everyone had to be home. Everyone, it was time for family to come back together again. And so I think I'm seeing companies do that a lot more. I sort of talk to people, say, in the tech space who generally are quite much more progressive, ERG groups, employment resources groups and things like that. So I think it's, you know, as you mentioned, the safety component of all this.
Yeah, I think it's, yeah, those things are good. But I think that what I'd like to see more companies doing is more than just celebrations. So, you know, are they really, really looking at this, you know, as part of their business, as part of really, you know, trying to progress talent through the organization as well? So I think that's my sense.
So that's the sponsorship component. Sponsorship
or the whole cultural diversity lens on what they're doing. Because I think they're doing a lot on gender. But one of the things I'd like to see personally is that we move away from just celebrations and we actually really see that, you know, this is a big component of our workplace. You know, we all have the need for new talent. Many of those people are going to come from Asia because we're short of talent. And so what are we going to do to not just encourage them, but really keep them in the organizations?
So I'm going to be a little bit ignorant in the sense that, like, what does sponsorship entail? Because sponsorship can be a big term.
Yeah, no, that's true.
Like, as in it's like, well, you're like, all right, I know I need to now do, I need to sponsor someone, but what am I doing?
Yeah. So there's a lot of, terms. There's one sponsor. Sometimes they use mentor.
Yep.
And so a sponsor is, and I've got a friend who has done research on it. She's described sponsorship as the people who help you to understand who to know and what to do. So I think who to know, these are often people who will introduce you to other people in your organization that you need to know. They will also lobby for you politically, maybe for promotions, help give you stretch assignments, will actually make sure that they give good word for you. So a sponsor is actually someone who actually will help you a little bit more politically in the organization.
Right.
And then there's also the what to know is that they will guide you on, you know, you should do this or maybe think about that or that sort of thing. So I think they're really important because there's, I mean, you could view them as a little bit more political, but that is important because you know, we're talking about relationships at work here. Mentors tend to advise you, and they may be in or outside the organisation. And, of course, there'll be, it's not as black and white as that. Some people will do various combinations in between. But the people who I spoke to generally all had strong sponsors, who are the ones who actually, you know, would make sure that, you know, you were being considered as part of the promotion slate. If they thought you were ready, they'd try and make sure that you were given the right opportunities and the right assignments.
Got it.
Yeah. But they're a little bit more organic. So the thing is, the challenge is people tend to prefer to work with people like them.
Mm.
And so, you know, a senior leader may prefer to find someone that's like him to sponsor rather than someone who's different.
And is sponsorship or mentorship something that you're exploring yourself with other people?
I've spoken about it in the book, but no, I guess for me, I would say that my sponsor was really key in making sure I got my promotions and supporting me through my career. In fact, I still talk to my sponsor on and off today, even though we've both left my organisation. So, you know, these are people who will always be there for advice. But, yeah, I think therefore, you know, others should also be aware that this is really important because I guess, unfortunately, as much as we hope that work is you know, there's less politics and that sort of thing, it is all about relationships and you know, who you connect with and who you get along with.
I'm sort of clawing a little bit here, but let's just say, for example, people understand they need to sponsor. What would motivate someone to sponsor? Because it's like,
that's one thing
to go, yeah, I need to sponsor someone. Mm-hmm. It's the right thing to do.
Yep.
But what constitutes that it's the right thing, and why should I, like, I guess the what's in it for me type thinking dialogue there.
Yeah. Yep. I mean, I think, you know, obviously, you need followers. But I think, you know, recognizing that you need different skill sets to do the work you do. So I think, you know, for me, I've been especially in Singapore, you know, being in groups where we're all very different. And I think you recognize that you can't do everything because all your clients are different, you know, but you all bring different skill sets. And so I think if you think about, you know, what you can bring and whether you can bring it, you will then realize, actually, I need all sorts of other skill sets. So that's a way to actually think about, well, how do I actually have a better team? You know, how do I actually do that? I need to find people and help coach them.
So instead of being one-dimensional because you have preference towards people who are similar to you.
I think if you think of what people and what diversity brings, I think, you know, I think you can recognize that, you know, no one is perfect and can do everything.
Yes.
But if you think from the perspective of, you know, these people bring all these different skills and I can help them, then that may be a way to look at it as well. Because, you know, as a leader, you need people to do your work, to follow you and that sort of thing. Mm. But if they're all the same, you may not actually produce the best product at the end of the day.
Yeah, I can definitely see that because I suppose the way my brain connects this all is otherwise you've got blind spots.
Yeah.
And you've got weaknesses, which what I guess diversity affords is the ability for people to come in with different lenses, different perspectives. Yep. They've got their strengths and their weaknesses as well, rather than, again, that sort of one-dimensional or two-dimensional map, you know, when ultimately you can have a very sort of diverse team.
Yep.
And that's the ultimate benefit for the person who does want to sponsor as well.
If you can bring them together and you can all work together despite the fact that you're different, you know, fingers crossed, you'll actually produce a better product or, you know, have more innovation or have more profits or whatever.
Mm.
Yeah.
Okay. So, like, changing an entire mindset amongst not just one industry but, like, all industries to do this is, like, obviously a behemoth of a task, right? Like, it's not something that, you know, even one person on their own can do it. And, you know, talking to Jay Young, you know, at Cal and running these sort of things, it's like what it does require from what I see is, like, sort of a collective mindset when it comes to doing this. What would you like to see? Like, I guess, you know, in terms of how, like, as in, I know I'm sort of trying to unpack in my head, but basically what I'm trying to say is it's one thing to go, yep, this needs to be done. But then it's like, well, again, practically speaking, it's like, what do we need to actually do? What are the first steps or what are the steps that we're already taking that we need to see more of?
I know this may sound a little idealistic, but I would hope that, you know, especially with the war for talent, that companies actually look a bit more holistically at how they try to develop people. If you think of, you know, I mean, that's a very business lens of looking at things, but it's true. There's a complete shortage of good talent in a number of industries. And so therefore, you know, I think most businesses should look at what they're trying to do to bring new ideas and people into their workplaces. And that probably means looking at different types of people. And therefore, what do they need to do to try to encourage those people to join and to stay? Because they can't afford to let people to go. So mm-hmm. I think a lot of companies need to revisit, well, what is diversity and inclusion and why is it important? It's actually linked to, you know, your business, it's linked to your talent.
Yes.
I think you need to think of it more than just it's a disclosure requirement or it's a KPI or I have to do it to make my disclosures look good. Yeah. I think, you know, it's important because, you know, you need staff. And so I think that's the start of it. But then also thinking, well, if I don't have that diversity, then what's leading to it? And it's not just that the people are not right. I think you also have to think about, is there something within my organization that is leading to maybe more people of a different background changing?
Yep.
Sorry, leaving.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, and then move from there. Well, what can I do to make my organization more attractive to, you know, whether it's millennials or people with different backgrounds and that they stay, they don't leave?
Yeah.
That's a big issue.
I think there's a change in mindset around now, like you said, war on talent, because companies don't you know, it's like when you talk about the property market, you got the buyer's market and seller's market, right? You got an employee's market or an employer's market right now. And I would argue right now it's an employee's market 100% because there's more choice, you know, because of the war on talent as well. So companies have to reframe and understand that it is not an entitlement now. It is now you have to work towards that. And the employer has to now think about things that they need to do to come to the party as well.
Yeah. And it's not just, you know, I think there are a lot of investors as well for the companies that have investors. Investors are looking very seriously at this as well. And, you know, they may not necessarily put money in your company if they're not necessary. You're not
interesting.
It's a big ESG push.
Okay.
If you think about ESG, and most of the time we talk about climate change, there is also that S element as well. So, you know, particularly maybe less in Australia, but definitely in the US, you know, a lot of companies may not invest in you if you don't have good diversity on your boards. And then they may even look at your workforce composition, because if you think about, you know, the major assets of a lot of these companies, it's their people.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, demographics and cultural diversity is not the only thing, but that data often is there.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, you're basically putting your money behind people and good talent. So it's actually important also because of this external pressure. And I don't think that will go away.
And is that because they see it as a risk if not diverse? Or what's the thinking behind this?
I think it's just a push to recognize that companies have a greater purpose, and that means that they have a social purpose as well.
Got it.
So it's all part of the ESG push.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Because I just come at it from a cynical lens because I would like to be pragmatic about this, which is that I think good intentioned people like us, you know, but it's not always reality, you know, in, you know, the quote unquote real world. And so I'm asking these line of questions because not all people are necessarily with the intentions that we have around this, whether it's social responsibility, ESG, that sort of stuff. And therefore they are motivated by oftentimes commercial reasons, like you said, for business. Yeah. And oftentimes if it's not from a bottom line perspective, it's like a no, it's nice to have, you know, not a priority.
I mean, these things are sort of rules which, you know, or practices overseas that are increasing, probably as recognizing that, you know, things aren't changing as fast as some people like. And so, you know, if people don't do the right thing, I think there are all these other external pressures coming as well.
What are you excited about though from like a, you know, what you're seeing coming through, whether it's here, Singapore, US, wherever?
Yeah, I mean, I think things are changing, even though it's slowly. And I think there's an increasing recognition that, you know, diversity is an important thing. I get really excited seeing young people having a lot of energy. So I think we all went to the 40 Under 40 Awards, and I think, you know, that's really great. There's some amazing talent come through. I guess what I'd like to see is, you know, after they're 40, is that they can continue those journeys and we see them, you know, doing other things. So, but I think, you know, slowly things are changing, but of course I'd like it to be faster.
Yeah. We'd all like it sooner.
Of course.
Yeah.
I guess for younger listeners out there or people who are looking to change career paths possibly, or even just looking for just a bit more of an inclusive space, what advice would you be able to offer for our listeners?
Yeah. Not easy. I mean, in a way, I've also changed my career as well when I left PwC and become a director. So it's not easy. I think you know, because in a way, once again, you're changing your identity. You're moving from, you know, say partner, in my case, to a non-executive director. My advice is really to try and find people to speak to. Even if I think about my own experience going from, you know, a partner and taking on director roles, I had to have a lot of coffee and I had to meet up with a lot of different people. Yeah. And I think at that stage, there weren't as many people I could speak to who were similar to me. But I think there are many people like you. So, and, you know, many people have gone through these similar situations. So don't be scared to ask someone for coffee. Don't be scared for help. Hopefully they can, you know, give you some advice and maybe introduce you to someone else and someone else. And so I would say that's probably one of the things to recognize. Feeling uncomfortable as you're doing these things is also normal. Mm-hmm. So I think, you know, have a think about it, decide if you like it or not. But, you know, I think, you know, if you really try passionate about it, give it a go and keep going, because sometimes these things take a long time.
And I think people need to actually take matters into their own hands here.
Definitely.
Yeah. I think we see a lot of, like, again, sitting on our hands and waiting for things to come to us when in actual fact it should be the opposite. Going back to your photocopying story.
Yeah.
very much so to do with that, because otherwise, if we spend time looking at each other, you know, going, who's making the first move? I don't think it'll ever happen, really.
Yeah, you need to get yourself noticed. You need to try things out and let people know what you're doing. So even for my director roles, I got my first role after I specifically told someone I was looking for director roles. And I think if I hadn't done that, they may not have then come back to me. Yeah, if you don't ask, you don't get type thing, right? Well, you know, that person then referred me to someone else. So I think sometimes you have to also not just do it, but tell people what you'd want to do. So I think that's important.
And I think the challenge with a lot of Asian Australians, and it'll be interesting to hear your thoughts, because you're fourth generation, you know, we're second generation, is oftentimes we say that we don't have the extended network. You know, we're not born into families and communities where, you know, mum's sort of an executive and dad's, you know, sort of does this, and then we've got an uncle who does such and such. Many of us. Yeah. You know, like, I think a lot of Asian families are just them and their family directly, and their parents probably are doing probably roles and jobs and businesses that are there to get by, more reactive than proactive. So there's two parts. Is there someone who's fourth generation? Did you find that you had a bigger network to be able to do that?
Probably not. No, okay. Because
that's interesting.
I was the first to go to university.
Oh,
yeah. Okay. So previous generations didn't.
No, my parents grew up in a time when unless you had money, you couldn't go to university.
Right.
So, you know, I think social, you know, your networks, you know, can be limited as well. But even then, I was lucky because my first vacation job was with their own family accountant. and honestly, I wouldn't, even though you at the time just thought it was menial and not very interesting, you still learned, and that then helped you build that confidence to do other things. But it's not easy, I agree. You know, I didn't have lawyers in my family or people who went to, you know, great different, you know, other big four firms and stuff like that. It's not easy, and you need to stretch yourself.
Yeah, and that's where the uncomfortable thing of, like you mentioned, going like for coffee, connecting with people, getting your face in front of people being aware of who you are and what you do, no matter how menial or how great the role is or the job, is probably the biggest lesson that I felt like I should have learned earlier on. Because I spent the first half of my career putting my head down, working really hard and thinking that I will get noticed because of that, when in actual fact you have to be more proactive by it. I think about, you know, when I was working in corporate, it's like unless you were, and I've spoken about this before, unless you're into like sports, you go to the races, like some of the stuff that just culture didn't fit in. Like I didn't grow up with that sort of stuff, you know, like
I don't play golf.
Yeah, you don't play golf. do you know what I mean? And I like sports betting and that sort of stuff. Like I just, and I had to probably, I was fortunate in the sense that I was very much into sports, and therefore that was my crutch that I could lean onto for conversations. But a lot of people don't have that.
It's not easy.
Just doesn't come naturally, right?
No, I have a friend who told me they had to learn how to have these conversations around the water cooler about, you know, so when they went to Melbourne, they needed to know what was happening with, you know, the AFL down there that weekend, because, you know, that's what everyone's speaking about. And that's really uncomfortable. But sometimes I guess you have to do some of these things if you want to.
Yep.
progress.
But I think the tendency for, at least in my experience seeing Asian Australians, is that if they're not interested, they don't try. Like, I see that a lot. I think that's my reality anyway, is that just, you know, you could be at the water cooler, and as soon as the topic moves in towards something that they maybe are not well-versed in that topic, it becomes immediately disinterested. See you later. I'll go back to doing what I'm doing.
And it's not easy. I mean, hopefully these things change over time, and we can talk about other things, you know. I mean, I love talking about food, but, you know, things will change. But I think, you know, I think we have to recognise that we are in Australia, and that's going to be something we're all going to have to deal with, is how to sort of pivot ourselves in different situations. Or even if you go overseas, you know, so I talk about food in you know, we all talk about food in Singapore, right? So, you know, that's fun.
No, totally.
Speaking of the future, like, do you have anything planned for the future, anything exciting you can share with us that you're doing personally, career-wise?
Yeah, no, I think I'm just seeing how things go with the book. I think it's been really interesting, and talking to organisations and seeing how I can sort of help with their conversations. But, nothing big at this stage.
Do you have any parting words of wisdom, I suppose, for, you know, listeners, particularly I think, again, about, you know, your area of expertise, which is, you know, when you're in a sort of bit more corporate environment or just, you know, any sort of company environment, to be quite honest, and you are an Asian Australian who's trying to get a leg up, you know, you sort of feel like you're a bit stuck and you're a bit in limbo right now. It's like, well, you know, Karen, what would you do in my situation? You know, what sort of advice would you have that we haven't mentioned?
I would say leveraging, your family, your friends and others for help. Really, you know, thinking about how you can leverage off them. But the other thing I think is really just continuing your learning. And I'm not saying just your technical learning, is that you just try new things out, you know, whether it's, you know, it's, you know, I don't know, Toastmasters or, you know, a course or something, because I think life's really long. And I think if you think that, you know, your technical skills that you learn at university will help you, I think, you know, you'll be out of date in 5 or 10 years, unfortunately. And so, you know, do different things. Be curious.
I think so. And I think also focus on things that are timeless, like communication is timeless.
Yeah. Soft skills.
It's, you're always going to need it.
Yeah.
And I think people get a bit fixated on what's the next big thing that I need to get my head around that's going to be really important. But when actual facts, like, well, instead of focusing what's going to change, focus on what never changes anyway, but it's still important as well. I think about, like, Jeff Bezos as a quote where everyone's asking him about, like, what's the next big thing that Amazon's interested in. He's like, why doesn't no one ever ask me about what's the thing that everyone always wants? They want cheap shipping. They want free shipping. They want fast. They want their stuff fast, and they want it at a good price as well. And so I think there's some learnings there, at least from my experience, around knowing that, you know, there are some things that are always going to stand the test of time that people need to learn. And I think that will hold them in good stead. But I think with the nature of being Asian Australian in a Western country, you know, Australia, we have to navigate, like you said, the reality is you're in Australia and there are cultures here that may not resonate with the cultures that you're brought up in, and you have to figure out how to navigate towards that as well.
In terms of finding more information about your book and how they can get their hands on it, as well as where can we find you online?
Okay, I have a website, so it's www.karenloon.com, and then you can find out about the book there and, you know, read a bit more about some of the other things I've written about.
Cool. Amazing. And LinkedIn as well, isn't it?
Yes, of course, LinkedIn, Instagram, Facebook.
Yep. Amazing.
Cross all boards. Thank you so much for your time today. Thanks for coming on to the podcast, Karen.
Thank you.
Thanks for coming on.
Thanks for listening to the Level Asian podcast. Make sure you subscribe and leave us a 5-star review if you enjoyed the episode. And why not share it with friends and family who might enjoy it too? Also, make sure you head over to levelasianpodcast.com to join our email list and to receive the latest updates and get notified when the next episode drops. If you know a great guest we should feature, email us at contact@levelasianpodcast.com or DM us on our socials in the show notes. Catch you on the next episode.